Welcome to Spotlight. Palestinian journalists are raising the alarm over what they describe as unjust suppression of their content on Facebook, a claim backed by rights groups. A spokesperson for Facebook's parent company, Meta, has rejected the claim, saying its policies were designed to give everyone a voice, but Palestinian reporters have cited multiple incidents they describe as censorship. Allegations of pro-Israeli bias at Facebook have been simmering for years and were renewed in October when an international human rights advocate group said the platform had suppressed content posted by Palestinians and their supporters speaking out about human rights violations by Israel. According to a Palestinian social media monitoring center, a record 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian Facebook posts were restricted or deleted in 2021 alone. Joining us now from Ramal is our correspondent, Mona Candy. Mona, how alarming are these findings?
Well, recently it was very clear that journalists and social media activists, when posting anything on Facebook, clearly mentioning the word, let's say, for example, martyr or martyrdom, or even Israeli crimes, massacres, that immediately Facebook would remove or delete such posts. Facebook has been removing these posts, claiming they violated the platform's standards. But Palestinians, as you have mentioned, see these claims as a pro-Israeli bias at Facebook, because when it comes to mentioning the Israeli crimes, when it comes to mentioning some issues in the occupied territories, then they would be seen as violating the platform Facebook standards. Palestinians today are saying that Facebook is simply having double standards, is simply backing the Israeli narration, why it's only the Palestinians who are suffering from these, from especially this treatment. Multiple incidents happened and they are seen as censorship. According to Palestinian social media monitoring center, Sada Social said that at least 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian Facebook posts were deleted or restricted. We can say that every day a number of Palestinians are being restricted to post anything. It's considered as a punishment just for addressing the Israeli crimes and just for posting some Israeli shootings that are carried out against Palestinians, or even if they write the word martyr in Arabic or martyrdom as well.
All right, thanks a lot, Mona Candy, joining us from Ramallah. Let's now take a look at the tail of the tape of our guest for Spotlight. Founding director of the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies from San Francisco State University, Rabab Abdullah, joining us from San Francisco. Also, we have Charlotte Cates from the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joining us from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Rabab Abdul Hadi joining us from San Francisco. Allegations of pro-Israeli bias at Facebook have simmered for years. Palestinian reporters have cited multiple incidents they describe as censorship. Is Facebook suppressing freedom of speech?
Yes, Definitely, there is a lot of evidence of that. The most recent attack has been the big campaign that Palestinian social media bloggers posted, which entitled Facebook Censors Jerusalem. And it was basically where Facebook basically blocked every single post in which Palestinians will, as your reporter said, mention the word martyr, shaheed, a prisoner, Jerusalem. They shut down the two big networks in Jerusalem. They shut down accounts for multiple Palestinians and so on. Facebook claimed that this was about their algorithm. But the question is that the algorithm is designed by people. So who plays these words to make them blocked by algorithm? But I think there is a bigger picture too, that Facebook has historically and continuously continued to block Palestinian content. I can just mention maybe a couple of examples historically by Facebook actually going and making a deal with the Israeli government, Facebook collaborating with the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which task is to actually block and silence Palestinian voices and Palestinian advocacy voices for Palestinian liberation around the world. Facebook also, Zuckerberg, met with the Israelis multiple times. They hired as one of the major media people in Facebook a former officer of the Israeli government who is known to be anti-Palestinian. I know from our own experience at the Arab and Muslim Ethnicity and Diaspora Studies program that Facebook has been targeted by several pro-Zionist groups that have tried to shut us down, starting in 2013 with the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which is in Los Angeles, which has been built, the so-called Museum of Tolerance, on the land of the Palestinian cemetery, Ma'manillah, Mamila, in Jerusalem. It was followed by my provost, my own academic provost, demanding that I take down a post in which I criticize my university president for welcoming Zionists to campus, which is supposed to be my own academic freedom. And the post that I posted was actually, I shared the post from one of our student groups, Jews Against Zionism, who said that they are opposed to welcoming Zionism on campus because of its colonialism, its racism, its apartheid. And it had a picture of a young student who was saying, I'm not anti-Zionist, I'm anti-Zionist, I'm not anti-Semitic, free Palestine. And so they thought that this was actually a violation. The university provost demanded that I take it down. The dean demanded that I take it down. And I said, no, I'm not going to be doing it. This is my academic freedom. As was condemned by the university president and the chancellor. But then afterwards, also last year, Facebook shut down our page completely, took down years of archives, of online classes, of syllabi, of material, of everything else. They are not explaining why they have done
that. Let's bring in Charlotte Cates on the discussion as well, Ms. Cates. Similar calls were renewed in October when an international human rights advocate group said that Facebook had suppressed content posted by Palestinians and their supporters speaking out about human rights issues human rights violations carried out by Israelis. So the claim is not just coming from Palestinian sources. Why is this happening, in your opinion? Why is information pointing out Israeli human rights violations and crimes? Are they being suppressed and concealed?
Well, when we look at the role of these big tech companies, so we've got Facebook, Twitter, Zoom, these kinds of big tech companies, they are engaged in shaping a narrative that works hand in hand with U.S. imperialism. These are some of the largest corporations that are currently based in the United States. And so we're seeing that being weaponized against Palestinian discourse, the censorship of words like martyrs, the censorship of the names of Palestinian political parties and organizations, in order to serve the interests, frankly, of U.S. imperialism and its alliance with the Israeli occupation. We see the same thing taking place in which content from countries targeted by sanctions and U.S. imperialism is labeled as state-sponsored content, while the same kind of content from official sources, for example, from the BBC or a German-sponsored media agency, are not labeled as state-sponsored content. And so this is an attack by big tech to control the access of to information that people have around the world because of the fact that Palestinians have been so successful in breaking the silence imposed upon the Palestinian cause by mainstream media and corporate media and imperialist states through their creative and active use of social media technology and various methods of communication.
Sure. Ms. Abdulhadi, an account of a Palestinian journalist was restricted twice this year, once just in December when videos depicting Israeli attacks on Palestinians were posted. In both cases, Facebook said it intervened because the posts violated the platform's standards. A spokesperson for Facebook's parent company, Meta, said that its policies were designed to give everyone a voice while keeping them safe on our apps, also adding, quote, "We apply these policies to everyone equally, regardless of who is posting." Is that the case?
Actually, that's definitely not the case. And there is so many flaws in this argument. One is that when they say they are applying equally, who is applying equally? And who's really setting the standards? And according to whom? And who's participating in it? We know there are high officials in Facebook who are setting it thus in consultation with various governments. They have done it again and again and again. So it's actually the whole question of equal is really not true, and it's a inaccurate labeling to start with. Secondly, the whole question of how they are setting up is also a question. Third is that why is it that Facebook is also shutting down, as my colleague Charlotte Cates said, shutting down posts also from, for example, on Kashmir liberation. They're shutting down posts on any other liberation around the world and actually allowing a lot of weaponizing of hate speech, of violence, of incitement to be there and succumbing to the pressures from various Israeli groups and various hate groups, various racist groups and so on. And it has to do with the fact that we're dealing with the Silicon Valley and we're dealing with Facebook as well as Zoom and other platforms which are very much profit related, and they are only concerned with their alliances and they're not really concerned with the truth and justice. They are only concerned with actually adding more ads and getting more people to subscribe. And so they believe that if they are suppressing Palestine, that might actually work. The problem with that is that it will always backfire because there is more and more people supporting Palestine. There is more and more people recognizing what's going on. Major human rights organizations have already documented and stated what has happened. Major electronic groups such as the Electronic Frontier Foundation and others have also documented what has been going on. So Facebook is actually really stuck now having to explain what is going on. So they're backpedaling to cover up the wrong that they are doing by aligning themselves with Israel and its racist and colonialist policies,
right,
and by suppressing Palestinian voices.
Right. Charlotte Cates, do you recall the issue? I think it was from earlier this year when young teenage girls were being targeted by sexual predators on Facebook. We spoke to a staff member right here on our channel from the company who alluded to lax protocols for monitoring content on Facebook. So let's hit pause there and come back to the issue that we're talking about right now regarding Palestinian posts. A Meta spokesperson said that it has a, quote, dedicated team which includes Arabic and Hebrew speakers who are focused on keeping our community safe by making sure we're removing harmful content. So which is it? They have a team of watchful eyes for pro-Palestinian content, but the pedophiles aren't as harmful?
Well, it's sad. If we look at May of this year, May of 2021, during the Unity Uprising throughout occupied Palestine, Facebook was seemingly a very safe place for hateful content by Zionist extremists encouraging violence in occupied Palestine 48 and participating in the ongoing riots targeting Palestinians in Palestine 48, assistance of the Israeli occupation army. And we've seen that systematically in hateful, racist, openly, blatantly racist content in the sources is deemed to be acceptable, while merely listing the name of a Palestinian political party like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, or the Popular Front for in a news article makes that same information dangerous by Facebook. And so what we see is that these big tech companies bring out the narrative of the Israeli occupation and of U.S. imperial Palestinian content. So it's also quite a safe space for forms of racist hatred, white supremacy, Zionist for Palestinian content, and for internationalist context imperialism. There's no concern for the community safety of Palestinians by Zionists. There's no concern for the community safety of Palestinians living under the bombs in Gaza, in exile around the world, or in being targeted by the guns of the occupier in the West Bank and Jerusalem or 48. Palestinian safety is considered to be something that is not the responsibility of Facebook, just like the Israeli mutual approach that's taken with the Israeli occupation. In we've seen time and time again that there are actually thousands and tens of thousands of reports filed by the Israeli occupation regime with Facebook on a regular basis. And we saw in 2015 during the Al-Quds uprising that was taking place that Israeli occupation essentially put strong pressure on Facebook and threatened to ban it within the country. And while Facebook was already a big tech company kind of serving U.S. interests, after 2015, we saw a dramatic escalation in the number of Palestinian posts being taken down and targeted because of this ongoing coordination that was established between Facebook and the Israeli occupation state.
Okay, Ms. Abdul-Hadi, according to Palestinian Social Media Monitoring Center, Sada Social, a record 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian Facebook posts were restricted or deleted in 2021. We said that's a record for the year. So the Palestinians, basically, they face an asymmetrical battle both on the ground and also in the media. What alternatives does that leave for the Palestinians? I think that's where many observers and commentators come in and say that resistance is the only alternative for Palestinians at this point.
Yes, of course. Palestinians, I should just say that, have been resisting for over 100 years the Zionist settler colonialism in Palestine. The resistance is not new. It continues and it keeps escalating and it keeps including more and more people. And every single time Israel succeeds in crushing a major defeat by conducting massacres, by killing hundreds of people and so on, that has happened multiple times around Gaza. That is happening sometimes silently, not even reported in the media, in Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah, in Silwan, in the Old City, in Lid, in Akka, in Haifa, in Bir Saba, in Naqab. This is happening all the time. And I think biggest part of the problem for Israel and its supporters, including Facebook, is that they have been unable to crush Palestinian resistance. They have been unable to say that this is a land without people for a people without a land. They failed. Israel has failed. Zionism has failed to do so. So they are escalating their aggression and their attempt to silencing and crush using the money accounts that they have with the pressures of the Facebook and Silicon Valley and so on. They're using the pressures with the Israeli Ministry of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. For example, there is this app called ActIL that sent 19,000 messages to Zoom to shut down an open classroom that my colleague Tomomi Kanekawa and I were organizing last year with the Palestinian feminist icon Leila Khaled. They continue doing this again and again. Sada Social is totally 100% correct in what is going on. So this means that, of course, Palestinians will continue resisting. They have no choice but to resist. A people that is suppressed is always going to yearn to be free. It will resist. It will continue to resist by every single aspect available to them, including the many Palestinian social media activists who are raising the voices high and making it known to us that there is censorship that is going on. Otherwise, we wouldn't know. People who are not inside Palestine and so on would not know what's going on. And the fact that the world is responding, the world is condemning what Israel is doing. We would like the world to be a little bit faster in that, so less Palestinian lives and less lives all around are being lost. But the Palestinians have no choice. They have to resist, and they will continue on resisting until all Palestine is free.
Right. Charlotte, Kate, one angle of all of this is trying to align anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. For example, if you criticize Israel, then you're being an anti-Semite. But we know that many Jews, even Israeli Jews, that criticize Israel for its rights violations and crimes. Is this just another way of trying to control the narrative, in your opinion?
Well, this is another example of the attempt to turn reality on its head. The reality is that the Palestinian Liberation Movement is an anti-fascist, anti-colonial movement that is on the side of all people who are fighting against racism, oppression, and discrimination and all. On the other hand, the Zionist movement is fundamentally a fascist that is based on racism, colonialism, and so by invoking the concept of when really Zionism is itself an anti-Semitic, in the concept of anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish prejudice, the leaders of Israeli war crimes and Israeli apartheid are attempting to change the discourse to focus instead on the idea that Palestinian colonialism and fighting back to defend their rights are somehow the oppressors in the nation. It's an attempt to turn reality on its head. In reality, if we want to, you know, anti-Jewish oppression, anti-Semitism, just like all forms of racism, this means standing hand in hand with the Palestinian liberation struggle, not hand in hand with the Zionist movement, which has increasingly built its ties with every far right and fascist regime around the world, regardless of their position on the crimes of the Nazis, regardless of their position on fascism. That's who the Israeli state is aligned with, okay. Is the far right, is the fascist forces.
Well, let's get a final thought in from Ms. Abdul Hadi. I'd like to get your thoughts on the same issue. Is all of this happening to control the narrative, making the previous statement that we just mentioned some kind of default, that if you're anti-Israeli, then you're an anti-Semite and you must be shunned and banned and silenced?
I will just say three points about this in addition to what we've already heard from your guest, Charlotte Gates. One is that, yes, they are trying to control the narrative. The Palestinian narrative is a narrative of resistance, of resilience, of steadfastness. Zionism is trying to impose a narrative of submission, subjugation, and defeat. And they are, of course, trying to do that. This is failing. This is something that actually is going on. That's one thing that's really, really important. Secondly, what does this really mean? It means that for all of us not to be silent, for all of us to say we will not be silenced, we're actually going to escalate and raise every single voice of Palestine high and amplify the Palestinian demands to be able to speak, to be able to express, to be able to reflect the reality on the ground to the outside world. The final point I would say is that there is so many more support for Palestine all over. Zionism claiming that that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism is failing also among multiple and broader ranks of Jews, not to mention other people around the world who are seeking justice. At the end of the day, Zionism has really failed, but that's why also bullies become bullier, become more vicious whenever they are
sure.
failing. The only solution is for us to continue resisting, raising our voices, speaking up, and saying we will not be silenced.
Indeed, and that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, founding director at the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies at San Francisco State University, Rabab Abdul Hadi, joining us from San Francisco, and also thanks to Ms. Charlotte Cates from the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joining us from Vancouver. And thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Allah, you are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
We're waiting for you to be my.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, you're listening to the program, The Lost Savior. We had been discussing in previous episodes about the tricks that the false claimants of Mahdaviyat have been using in order to trap people. And on that note, we have with us in our studio, Dr. Murtaza Karimi, who is a PhD scholar in Islamic studies. Assalamu alaikum, doctor.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so much for accepting the invitation.
My pleasure.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Dr. Karimi, in the last episode, you talked about ARIZA, wherein we analyzed what is ARIZA. Is it valid or invalid, or shall we rely on it or not? You give a complete explanation of ARIZA. Now, how is the same trick or other tricks used by these claimants who claim to be attached to Imam Zaman?
Of course, ARIZA in and of itself is not a trick. We mentioned that although it's not mentioned in very authentic narrations, it can be acted upon because of the fact that at the end of the day, there are some narrations about that. So it can be looked upon as a form of tawassul or resorting to the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. So in and of itself, it is allowed. It's not an innovation. But now, one of the tricks used by these false claimants is through ARIZA and writing ARIZA. And the fact is that we see in the history of some of these false claimants that if you want to talk to Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, write your requests in a paper, write an ARIZA, give it to me, I will give it to Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. And this is one of their tactics and tricks. So from this perspective, we call it a trick used by these false claimants.
All right. So as the world is coming towards the point that we should not be dropping these letters or ARIZA into the wells and all, now these claimants come up and say that, give it to me and I'll directly give it to
Imam. That's the point. And unfortunately, there are some lay people who trust these people and they think that, okay, I mean, he's an intermediary between
me and
Imam Mahdi.
They will, because people want to get connected to Imam.
That's the point. Now, I think based on the explanations that I mentioned in the previous program, it's very crystal clear that according to the narrations related to the concept of ARIZA, if we may refer to these narrations, there is no mention of any intermediary between the person who writes the letter and Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. In all those narrations, they say that write the ARIZA, write your request, you may recite some supplications, even you may say a 2 rak'ah of prayer, and then just throw it in the well or running water or, a river. There is no mention of giving ARIZA to a deputy of the Imam. Even you cannot find even one narration in this regard. So the point is that as Shia, we need to stick to the narrations the way that the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam themselves, they have instructed us. If we are going to act upon the concept of ARIZA, we may do it, but then just to throw it in a well or running water.
So we don't have even in narrations that there is some intermediate to be
not
carrying the ARIZA.
Not at all.
Right.
Not only for that, after the death of the fourth deputy of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam during the minor occultation, Ali ibn Muhammad Samuri, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam said that from this time onwards, there is no deputy, there is no special deputy. Which means that there is no intermediary between me and the people.
There is no naib.
We have general deputies in the forms of the great jurists and scholars, but they are not the intermediaries. They are just general deputies appointed by Imam Mahdi, alayhi salam. So the point is that, our dear listeners, if you find any person who claims that he will give the ARIZA to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam,
do not believe him.
Yeah, just make sure that he's nothing but a liar. So this is one of the ways that we can recognize the false claimants. According to the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt, in the period of major occultation, whoever claims that he is a special deputy of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, he can meet Imam Mahdi alayhi salam whenever he wishes. He can give the ARIZA to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. All these people are just false claimants and
nothing
big liars.
More than that.
Nothing more than that. So that's the trick that
that's
is used
really
by some
clever.
Of these false
that's
claimants.
That's really very clever that people, a human brain even accepts that maybe some intermediate can take my ARIZA to Imam, not the water. And this is a very, very clever trick to be used.
Still, it is rooted in, psychological problems that people are suffering from. And these false claimants, they misuse the pure feelings of the people.
Right.
People are suffering a lot from different problems and they are looking for any solution.
Right.
And as soon as they find a person claiming that I'm able to visit Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, take your ARIZA to him, unfortunately, some people just trust him. But the point is that the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, including Imam Mahdi himself, they have told us that this is not the case, and there is no special deputy during the major occultation.
Alright, Dr. Karim, we will be talking to you about these tricks. Here we need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old pain.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and we have Dr. Murtaza Karimi with us, who is an Islamic scholar. And we had been talking about the false claimants of Mehdi, what kind of tricks they use. Before a break and in previous episodes, Dr. Karimi, we analyzed some of the tricks like Istikhara and Ariza. Now, is there some other trick that is being used by these claimants?
Yes, sure. The next one is related to what we call it in Islamic theology, the miracle or mu'jiza.
Yeah.
We know that one of the most important ways to recognize a true prophet and a true imam is through miracle. When a prophet performs a miracle, which means a superordinary action that he himself performed and other people are not able to do that, and at the same time he claims that he is a prophet or imam, this is one of the signs that he is telling the truth, he is the prophet or the imam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the point is that when it comes to the false claimants, they also know the fact that if they want to convince the people that they are telling the truth, they are either Imam Mahdi or his special deputy, they need to perform a kind of miracle. Because of the fact that at the end of the day, they are just telling lies and they are not able to perform real miracles, they try to forge some miracles. I will explain how.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, they are trying to deceive the people that this is my miracle and you need to accept me because I'm showing you this miracle. Now, in the history of Islam, we have some people, false claimants, who have claimed to have shown miracles. Before talking about one of the most famous one in our time, I may refer to the founder of Babi school of thought, Ali Muhammad Bab. We know that this is a very deviant group, and according to all Muslim scholars, they are not Muslim at all because of the very wrong beliefs that they believe in. Now, when it comes to Ali Muhammad Bab, the founder of this school, once in a session in the city of Tabriz in Iran, people asked him that, okay, you call yourself Bab, which means the gate to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, show us the miracle. And then he said that, okay, my miracle is that I have a staff in my hand and I'm able to reveal a verse about this staff. And then he recited the following verse. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم سبحان الله القدوس السبوح الذي خلق السماوات والأرض كما خلق هذه العصا آية من آياته. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, immaculate is God who created all the heavens and the earth. You see, this is to some extent taken from the Noble Book of Quran. This is not something new. The new part of this verse is that as he created the heavens and the earth, as he created this staff of mine. And this is one of the signs of God.
All right.
So first of all, when he was reciting this Arabic text, he made some mistakes in applying the Arabic
rules,
grammatical rules for even reading this one verse, so-called verse. And then he also said that the other miracle of mine is that I'm able to write down 1,000 verses, poetic verses, I mean, during one day. This is a miracle of mine. Now, Let me also refer to another case in our time, then I will analyze these miracles to come to conclusion that whether these are true miracles or just false miracles
claims.
And the forged ones. One of the most famous claimants in our time, which is from Basra, we talked a lot about him.
Yeah.
He claims that I have various miracles. One of them is that, for example, I know that the grave of Lady Zahra Salamullah
Alayha,
yeah, I know where she is buried.
God.
Her grave is next to the grave of Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam in the cemetery of Baqi.
Okay.
This is my miracle. And unfortunately, I mean, many of his followers nowadays, they believe in that.
Oh,
they say that, you see, he knows where that
the
hidden grave is.
We have not been able to
find
it, discover
miracle.
It, and this person told us so simply.
Other miracles that are attributed to him is that, for example, one of his followers says that a person was suffering from a cancer, and then after he believed in these false claimants, he was cured. Or in another case, he rubbed his hand on the eyes of a person, then he was able to see the angels, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So these are some of the miracles attributed to Ali Muhammad Bab and this false claimant from Basra. Now, the point is that, again, this is a kind of trick used by these people. Why? Because, as I mentioned, technically speaking, mu'jaza is from the root hajaza, which means an action which other people cannot do the same. If other people can imitate that at the same time, it's not a miracle anymore. So at the time of Prophet Musa alayhi salam, we know that many people were expert in magic. But what was performed by Prophet Musa alayhi salam was not a magic. And that is why those magicians believed in Moses alayhi salam. Why? Because they knew for sure that this is not magic. And they were not able to perform what Musa alayhi salam performed. At the time of Jesus alayhi salam, there were some experts in medicine. But Prophet Isa alayhi salam cured some people who were suffering from special illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And those people knew that it's a miracle. Or he revived a dead person. No one could imitate Jesus alayhi salam. So this is the technical definition of a miracle. A person claims that he's a prophet or imam, then he performs one action, and other people are not able to do the same. Now, having said that, let's talk and see whether these actions are really miracles or not. So first of all, we see that both claims of Ali Muhammad Bab, they are actions which can be done by other people as well. Interestingly, in the same session, it is reported that when Ali Muhammad Bab said that this is my first miracle, I can reveal a verse about my staff, a person whose name was Amir Aslan Khan, he said that if this is the case, I can claim the same because I can reveal the following verse. Alhamdulillah alladhi khalaqa al-asa kama khalaqa sabaha wal-masa. Even it is more rhetoric than yours. It is proving that when this can be done by other people, then it's not
a miracle anymore. At
or
the same time.
Even writing down, 1,000 lines of poetry within one day is something that can be done
by
anyone.
We have seen some extraordinary people around.
Yeah. So this is the point about Ali Muhammad Bab. Mu'jaza should be in a way that other people cannot do the same.
Dr. Karimi, we are running out of time, and inshallah we'll be talking to you in the next episode.
Sure, I mentioned some miracles attributed to this false claimant from Basra. We need to analyze whether these are true miracles
or not
in the following
session. Inshallah we'll be talking about that in the next episode. This is Zainab with our whole team saying goodbye.
Where is the rising sun?
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روبا شابت غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
راشا ساقلم اسطنبول
سيد امين علمي كابل
شهانة بات اندين ادمنسترد كشمير
Round the world with reporters
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days, but is finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity. Thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
In late 2020, Americans went to the ballots to pick the country's next president. 4 days after votes closed, Joe Biden was declared the winner, but the incumbent leader, Donald Trump, alleged vote fraud. and in doing so, shattered Washington's self-proclaimed image of the cradle of democracy. Trump adamantly refused to concede defeat after losing the 2020 presidential vote. On January 6, 2021, he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and, quote, "stop the steal." His fans attempted to do that. The world was shocked as news networks around the world showed thousands of Trump supporters forcing their way into the Capitol building, the symbol of U.S. democracy. Lawmakers engaged in the process of certifying the presidential election had to stop their task and flee for their lives. Some reports even suggest that a Republican senator was so frightened that he asked the Capitol security repeatedly to shoot the protesters. 5 people died in the chaos, one of them in the Congress building. To date, American authorities have arrested nearly 600 people and are looking for hundreds of more suspects. A big portion of the defendants stand accused of assaulting police officers. The FBI asked U.S. citizens to report each other out and tell the police if they knew anyone who had taken part in the riots. The incident inevitably had adverse consequences for the United States' image, both domestically and internationally. An opinion poll conducted last year by Harvard University showed that more than half of the country's young generation thought that American democracy is in trouble or failing. Moreover, an Axios survey indicated that now only 51% of the U.S. public thinks the next presidential election will be fair and free. Also, the Democracy Perception Index for 2021 showed that 44% of participants perceive the U.S. influence and meddling in the affairs of their countries as the biggest threat to democracy in their nations. At the same time, politicians and political analysts express shock and disgust at the chaotic scenes at the Congress grounds. Richard N. Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said the attack signaled a post-American era. The assault on the Capitol changed the face of Washington, D.C. as well. The Congress building was fenced off on multiple occasions after the riots. Furthermore, Joe Biden's inauguration was carried out under heavy military presence, with an unprecedented 25,000 troops ensuring security. That was bigger than the number of U.S. forces present in Iraq and Afghanistan on the same day. The police reaction to the Capitol riots also raised questions about the U.S. law enforcement's differential treatment of white protesters. Whereas black people could be killed and injured for much smaller crimes, police were in fact criticized for their late and subdued response to the deadly protests by Trump's supporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasem transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad Nakhala, described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American-Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witnessed that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States.
Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others.
Participants of the conference stress on the need of unity among Muslims and call on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discords among Muslim Ummah.
Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the US to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam like Islam. And they mention many things that hurt the heart of the Islamic people, while Islam is the religious of love between the people.
This conference is very important for me, all Pakistanis and all Muslims, because there has been so many criminal activities on behalf of non-Muslims or Western countries against Islam and Muslims.
Member of the international conference warned the Islamic countries to act quickly against the possible future threats given the previous experience with the West.
Islamophobia had been created to balance the teachings of Ahle Bayt alayhimus salam. It was created to balance and misguide people from the way of Quran and Sunnah. Things took place in the name of Daesh and so-called. And they did things which were absolutely against the teachings of Islam. They never understood.
The delegation in the conference also stressed the significance of the eradication of Daesh from Iraq and Syria to save Islam and also save humanity from the plague of terrorist groups like Daesh, which is seen as a Western plot against Islam and the Islamic community. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. 2 decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague. and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saipur is up, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lashed out at the United States as the mother of corruption and terrorism in the region and stressed that the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region will be the final revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad in 2020.
We've declared earlier that the best revenge is the full withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. And over the past 2 years, as the leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the U.S. has been forced to leave Afghanistan with humiliation. This has led the U.S. allies to rethink their alliance with Washington.
In an address to a ceremony in Beirut remembering the martyrs Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and their companions, Sayyid Nasrallah also accused the U.S. of being behind all Israeli and Saudi crimes in the region for decades.
The lesson which I would like to highlight today is that everyone acting for the sake of God emerges victorious in all battles and wins the hearts and minds of all people across the Arab and Muslim worlds. They show us that the U.S. serves as the real enemy and source of corruption, occupation, and terrorism in our region.
Analysts believe that the project of the resistance continues to face the criminality of the U.S. in Lebanon and the region.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani belongs to the school of thought of a struggle against the occupiers of our land and those who destroyed our homes and killed our people and led one war after the other with their support for the Zionists. He sacrificed his life and stood against terrorism in Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon and Palestine. He taught us that Lebanon is strong enough and can remove itself from the U.S. hegemony.
The leader of the resistance stressed that the assassination of martyr Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has triggered a new phase at the regional level.
The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and PMU commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis is seen as an incident larger than the region itself, and for many analysts has brought to light a long-term confrontation for Lebanon's Hezbollah facing U.S. influence in Lebanon and the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is highly respected among Afghan people because of his leadership role in resisting invasion and Takfiri groups in the region. Afghans consider him as a hero who inspired them to find freedom and defeat the invaders. To commemorate Lieutenant General Soleimani's sacrifices and bravery, Afghan leaders, clerics, and experts gathered at the Iranian embassy in Kabul, highlighting his role in unifying Muslims and forming an anti-terror resistance in the region, especially Afghanistan.
Martyr Soleimani was a righteous servant of God. He was committed to Islam's holy values and ideals, so he devoted his life to serve Muslims and the oppressed and fight devils and Takfiri groups. He fought the U.S. hegemony in the region and didn't let it interfere in Islamic countries' affairs and create terror and war in the region.
Shahid Qasem Soleimani.
Martyr Soleimani managed to unify Muslims around the globe. He always used to show up wherever he was needed. For Afghanistan, he was a friend. He met resistance forces and Afghan top leaders to motivate and empower them to defend their soil against terrorists and invaders. Therefore, we owe the victory over the U.S. to the anti-terror General Soleimani.
Some Afghan teenagers, considering themselves as the followers of Lieutenant General Soleimani's school of thought, have held the Sunday Wushom match on the occasion of the second anniversary of the martyrdom of their fearless role model.
All matches held here in support of Commander Soleimani. We, the young generation of Afghanistan, are followers of his school of thought. We love the commander's attitude and adopt him as our role model in bravery, faith, and modesty. That is why most matches are named after him.
Lieutenant General Soleimani not only played a major role in defeating Daesh terrorist group in Syria and Iraq, but also had a direct relation with Afghan resistance forces to help them defeat terrorist groups and put an end to invasion on their soil. Afghans marked the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of the anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani as they are still suffering from time-to-time Daesh attacks. For Afghans, Martyr Soleimani is a hero and a role model for fighting against terrorism. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.